Yo, what is going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast. Michael, can you do a Show Me the Meaning since we don't have the usuals here?
Yeah, sure. Show me the meaning, please.
That was the Larry David version of Show Me the Meaning.
I didn't want to copy Ryan. You know, I felt like that would be disrespectful.
That was the bumbly and awkward version. But what up? My name is Austin Hayden, and I am joined by Michael Burns. What's going on, brother?
Not much. Very happy to be here. Very excited to talk about what we're going to talk about today. And very excited just to chat with you one-on-one, you know? Very special.
Yeah. People don't know this, but we went to grad school together. And so we actually lived together for a little bit. You were my mentor in some ways. And so now this is like a reunion here. He was my philosophical mentor. And so now we get to talk about art and meaning and things like that in the most watched television series on Netflix ever. In fact, it is the most watched thing ever, more than the freaking sunset. I didn't know if you knew that, but they've measured this. We're talking about Squid Game, which is created by, and listen, I actually went online and I tried to learn how to pronounce these South Korean names, so if I butcher these, forgive me.
No.
I'm doing my best here, but Hwang Dong-hyuk is the creator, writer, director, and it stars Lee Jung-jae, Park Hae-soo, Shi Ha-joon, Jung Ho-yeon, Ho Sung-tae, and Oh Young-soo, as well as others. I'm also going to do my best with character names. Michael, you did pretty good in the video that we just did with character names. How are you feeling about the character names?
I feel like if they were in front of me right now, I could say them properly. I feel like I'm not going to now. But it was, you know, we tried our best in the video to honor those names while also being honest about the fact that I don't speak South Korean. I wish I did.
Yeah. And is there much of a difference? And I would love to know this. If you can tell us, we are live, by the way, in the chat. So if you can communicate with us in the chat, we'd love to hear it. You can write with us. You can tweet at us, SMTM_POD. Tell us, is there a difference between, in the dialect, between the North and the South much? Or is it pretty much identical? I mean, slang differences and things like that.
So they implied that in the show.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I should pull up the character names in front of me. I should have thought about that before. But yeah, that is implied.
Se-byeok is the woman who's from North Korea. That's
yes.
The character.
So it's implied that Se-byeok has to switch her accent to speak in proper Southern Korean. And she's sort of like called out for speaking North Korean. And just, I don't know. I think that's, I mean, so much more to get into. But even that was interesting in the show. Thinking about those cultural differences that we don't think of. Thinking about like... Yeah. How are like Pakistani migrant laborers treated in South Korea?
Yeah.
I don't think about like, you know, a lot of good stuff comes up. Lots to think about.
All right. So basically what we're going to do is, here's the elevator pitch for Squid Game, right? In this series, down on their luck, indebted competitors compete in a series of children's games, but with murderous twists, for the chance to win gobs and gobs of money and putatively free themselves from their debt bondage. As I said, this is the most, or it's on pace at least, to be the most watched thing ever on Netflix. I just read something yesterday that said that the series itself is estimated as being worth over $900 million for Netflix. I don't know however they do their asset valuation, but it has to do probably with eyeballs, new people coming on, how long people stay on the app, etc., etc. But anyway, so it's a $1 billion property. They're talking about a second season. And there's a really cool story also behind how the show was made. So we can talk about all of this. Normally we would go around when we're doing a film and we would get first impressions and if we've seen it multiple times. I have a feeling, Michael, you have not seen the whole series more than once, even though you've probably seen excerpts twice because you just did a video on it that we released on the main channel, by the way, so people can check that out. But let's just say, what are your first impressions, and then kind of what was it like as you started to scrape beneath the surface and really started to think critically about this?
I mean, I think I was lucky that I went into it knowing nothing. Shout out to Wisecrack producer Evan, who basically said, like, Burns, you should watch this so we can think about if I want to do something on it. But didn't know a lot going into it. I just think one thing that stood out to me a lot tonally was how this show shifts between elements of, you know, straight up comedy and kind of like there's a, like yeah. a very like quirky vibe at the beginning. And even like in the first episode, the character that plays Ji-Yoon, it's kind of like this schlub who's like, "Mom, I don't want to do this. Can I have some money?" Like there's yeah, something
yeah.
comedic.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, and the way they get so dark and intense so quick, I think plays with you as a viewer. And I think that stood out to me throughout the tonal balance they got in the show. And then I just like, yeah, the exploration of debt, and this is something we'll talk about. I know it's something we both have thought about. I know it's something you've written about before. But I thought using debt as the way they do throughout the series was really brilliant. I think the show had a couple missteps, but when it was firing on all cylinders, like shout out to episode 6, just a really phenomenal show. And I'm so glad that, I don't know, not to praise Netflix, but their model here of, you know, yeah. taking an international show and really putting it on a global audience really worked out this time around. So, yeah, how about you? Like, what was your experience in watching this one?
Yeah. So the very first time I was introduced to it was, you know, the little trailer. I think it was, like, recommended from the algorithm. I probably because everyone was uh-huh. watching it, too, and it kind of popped up. And I saw these figures with these masks, and they were kind of, like, talking about the rules. And I was like, oh, this looks like some sort of social commentary. Like, I immediately knew. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of, like, Cube, or I was thinking of some sort of, like, Hunger Games-y Battle Royale, which I immediately was thinking that. I was like, oh, okay, so it's this like either dystopian or some sort of satirical. It kind of immediately stood out to me that that's what it was. Mm-hmm. And because I didn't know that that I was listening to dubs, and it was the people in the masks talking, I had no idea that it was.
You did dubs, not subs?
Well, no, only that trailer part. And
oh,
then,
okay, yeah.
And then I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then I saw that it was the Korean actors. Then I was like, oh, wait a second. So they're fucking dubbing? I was like, why would they dub? I was like, dubs are terrible. But for some reason, Netflix's default was dubs on mine anyway. And I was like, this is so weird. So then I just didn't think anything of it. I was like, oh, that looks kind of whatever. You know, it's a thing. And then I saw all the hubbub online. And I was like, oh, I guess I gotta check this out. So I was on a walk one day with my girl who hates like horror things. And I was like, should we get into this Squid Game thing? She's like, yeah, let's get into it. And then we were hooked. And immediately from the first episode, my initial thought was, this doesn't look like it's filmed like a TV series or a TV show. It felt like a film. It felt very cinematic in the way that it was shot, the lighting. It felt like I was watching something. Like if you would have told me at a film festival that this was some new South Korean director that I was unfamiliar with and this was their new thing, I was like, yeah, it had all the elements, that lighthearted kind of humor that you were talking about, but mixed with the serious social commentary. I was like, yeah, this fits perfectly within, you know, something that you might see coming out of South Korea alongside a lot of these other great hitters that we often talk about on this show, for example.
Yeah.
So that was my first impression. And then it started to unfold and I was like, oh, this is clearly social commentary. And I was actually baffled that so many people online were debating whether or not the show had a social angle. I was like, guys, it's not even fucking subtle.
Yeah, this wasn't like hidden meaning here. Like, I think we have a lot to talk about on this episode, but I think that we're not going to sit here today and be like, ooh, what this really meant. Like, you all get it. I think we can expand that and talk about what this means in context of a lot of things, but not a subtle thing.
No. So, and then we watched it, we were hooked on it, and it was weird. It was one of those shows that when it ended, I was like, you know, it really did, because it stirred up a lot of conversation with within the household, but also just with friends and stuff like that. And I was like, oh man, I want more. So it left me wanting more, which is great. And I'm pretty sure they'll probably put together a second season. They would be fools not to, considering how much money this dang show is going to make them. So,
oh my God. And I do think it's interesting to note that you talked about it looking like a film. I know that it was originally pitched as a film, and then the writer-director expanded it. I think sometimes you can notice in a series when you find out that it was originally a film, then spread out over, you know, 6 or 8 episodes. Sometimes you can tell they've put in a bunch of fluff, you know, to sort of take up narrative space because they don't have, let's say, 6 episodes. This was an instance, for the most part, where they did such a great job of expanding what was originally meant to be, you know, presumably a 2-hour film into something that was, you know, 7.5, 8 hours long. So definite shouts to them on that.
Yeah. Really well constructed. So what we'll do is we'll start peeling things apart. Obviously, there are things that a lot of people have been talking about. And then I think there are some things that we addressed in our Wisecrack video that I think we should definitely talk about. And then there might be some other things that haven't been addressed so much that I feel like maybe we can try to kind of tease things out. But first, before we do that, we got to give a shout out to our sponsor for this week's episode, Skillshare. Y'all know the deal. Skillshare is rad. It's an online learning community where you can connect with other like-minded people and creatives and where you can explore projects that you are passionate about. And this is why Skillshare is really so cool, is because you can unleash your creativity and you can pursue your passions right from the comfort of your own homes. And they offer thousands of classes that you can take. iPhone photography, drone filming, editing, classes on improving productivity, video for IG. I go back to Skillshare a lot for things about like filming, editing, and kind of some of the motivational ones, just because as an artist, you can never have enough kicks in the butt to light those fires. So if you're interested in checking out all the cool stuff that Skillshare has to offer and explore your creativity, connect with some cool people, go to skillshare.com/smtm and you'll get a free trial of their premium membership. So that's skillshare.com/smtm. Get a free trial of the premium membership, skillshare.com/smtm, or you can click the link down in the show notes. All right. As I said, also, we are live on YouTube right now. So definitely, I mean, this show has created such a buzz. I'm sure people don't have a shortage of hot takes or fan theories or things that they loved. So please comment in the chats and we'll do our best to get to some of those. But Michael, let's start with the video that we made. The big theme, indebted subjects, indebted man. We talked about the philosophy of Lazzarato, who wrote a book called The Making of Indebted Man, and we talked about how that might be the kind of prime way to understand the socioeconomic or political economic concepts of this. Can you explain a little bit about what's going on there with indebtedness?
Yeah, and you know, I'm excited to talk to you about this because I know Austin, a lot of your kind of reason. I don't know how many people, you know, there's many sides to Austin. I don't know how many of you dig deep into his academic side, but someone who's kind of pivoted since back in the day, and you do a lot of cool stuff on economics and things like that now. So excited to hear your thoughts on this. I mean, it kind of worked out because I started reading Mauricio Lazzarato before Squid Game came out, just as like a wanting to get back into reading some political theory and stuff like that. I love Italians, great food, great culture. So it was already in this mind space. And when I started watching Squid Game, I was like, oh. So Lazzarato, who's a Italian political economist and theorist who I think has been based in France for a lot of years, is really interested in the concept of indebtedness as like the foundational concept in political theory and looking at Western societies. And in particular, in this concept of indebted man, he wants to make the argument that indebtedness is a fundamental feature of what it means to be a modern subject in, you know, Western capitalist societies. And he traces it back, and, you know, David Graeber does this as well in his big book on debt, but traces it back to, at least Lazzarato goes as far back as Nietzsche and looks at Nietzsche's arguments for debt and guilt, and his writings on morality, connects that to Christianity and this idea that you are born with a fundamental debt or guilt. So you owe something to God. So you kind of have like a spiritual debt. And Lazzarato sort of argues that this set things up perfectly for an economy based on debt, because you already had individuals with an internal psychology that said, you know, I always already owe something and I'm defined by debt. So then we transfer that in an economics sense, and, you know, he makes it very clear as well that it's not in his mind incidental that in the West rates of debt, both, you know, the debts nations have and the debts that individuals have, it's a feature, not a dysfunction of the system. It is a part of how things are designed to work. And I think that really stood out to me in relationship to the show, because you saw how all of these people's lives are so defined by debt. And I really do think, you know, in episode 9, I'm pretty sure, when June's getting his haircut and his red dye job, they cut to a TV for a second. And it's like a Korean news report on the rising rate of debt amongst people in society. So it seems very clear that, like, that's going on. But all that to say is, that's the stuff from Lazzarato that stood out to me is very interesting. That's kind of what we touched on in the video a bit.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So, like, when we You oftentimes might hear people in economics talk about liquidity, insolvency, and we don't really know what these terms might mean. And we know they're related to money and financial flows. And one of the things that I've been really working on a lot alongside the work of a theorist by the name of Michelle Fair is this notion of liquidity as being something that defines us as humans. And so liquidity is basically the capacity to meet your obligations. Right? And so if you are illiquid, that means you do not have access to something that can be easily transformable so that you can meet your obligations. So like an illiquid asset would be like a house, right? It could be worth a lot of money, but you can't really sell it super quickly so that you can get access to the money so that you can meet the obligations that you might need in the form of money, which is generally considered the most liquid because you can exchange it immediately. Because if I got money, you need money, someone needs the money, so we can figure out how things work, right? So we can think of this in terms of like an indebted subject as somebody who does not have one solvency in the sense that they don't have much access to asset wealth, but more importantly, they are incapable. They are incapable of something. And we live in a society that requires a certain type of capacity. So the idea then, of course, of being a liquid subject is that you are a subject that has a certain type of capacity because you have been shaped and you have been formed and you have been fashioned in the kind of fires of being asset wealthy or at least better positioned within kind of like the asset paradigm, which means that you do have a capacity, right, that is not on offer to everyone. I think what you get then with all of these people, they are indebted, sure. So they're indebted. The obligations that they owe are to what, the state or to the bookies or to family members or to their banks or to investors or whatever. So they have obligations, but their problem is that they're fundamentally unable to meet those needs. So they are all illiquid subjects. So they have no capacity. So they are impotent. In the literal sense of the word, they have zero potency. They have no power, right? So then what happens is this game comes along and they're kind of, it's a sort of like they're forced into it. It's not like, you know, they talk a lot about equality in the game and you kind of, it's like they use the guise of, oh, this is like an equal opportunity, but there's a fundamental incapacity that forces them to be in this situation in the first place. And then the only way that they can have any kind of power is by playing according to the rules of the game that are set before them.
Yeah. Right? Well, it's like this existential versus economic freedom thing. I think that we get obsessed with this idea of freedom as being something that defines like our baseline existence in the world, and that I'm free to say whatever I want. I'm free to, you know, set off a car bomb or drink a glass of water, whatever it might be. But, you know, I think the show gets at that tension. And I think, I mean, for me, two of my favorite parts in the show are the parts where the front man sort of explains, like, I'm so sorry for what's happening. This is a game of equality, a true democracy, and people breaking the rules ruin that. And it's just like, I don't think the show is a satire, but I think those are the moments where the show is explicitly doing satire. And particularly satire about what freedom means.
Yeah, I think we're supposed to look at that and be like, well, clearly this is absurd. Like, what you're saying is ridiculous. Like, yeah, you can, for some reason, there's like this perverse pleasure you get in believing that there is equality down here. But this isn't any sort of meaningful sense of equality, right? Like, yeah, there's a formal equality within the rules of the game, but these fools are all seriously hamstrung in their capacity. And equality means nothing without potency, without power, without some sort of ability.
And I think, you know, this is what you get kind of between, and once again, everyone, truly try my best to honor all the characters' names, but between Jiyun and Sang-woo is this difference between how we respond to what is like a forced point of freedom. And Sang-woo is kind of just like, fuck it, this is where we're at. If I have to get Ali killed, spoiler alert, I'm going to do it. And it's sort of this acknowledgement of like, there isn't freedom. There's only survival. There isn't life. There's only that baseline of survival conditions. So fuck freedom. Mm. I'm going to do what I have to do. And then you see Jiyun like try to hold on to this idea of trying to like embrace his own freedom and to acknowledge the humanity of the other players in the game. And towards the end of the series, I think you see that. And of course, I think that's what a reflection in modern society, because we often hear like, you know, especially when people get older, people start to like give away the idealism of their youth, and you got to live in the real world. You have to work within the conditions that we're given. We live in the real world, not the ideal world. And I felt like you saw that tension a little bit build throughout the show, but especially between those two main characters.
What do you think the show is saying about, let's take Jihyun and Sang-woo. Like, is one, like, Sang-woo kind of emerges, at first we think it's the gangster guy that's the baddie, but really Sang-woo comes out to be the ultimate villain, and he's the one, remember, that Jihyun grew up with, and that is like, oh, every time he talks about him, like, he graduated from university, you know, he's like the hero of the neighborhood,
the golden
and now he's like
boy
super
of town,
successful.
Yeah.
That's right, and then he becomes the one who's ruthless, who seems to not really have any sort of concern about humanity. And then you have Jihyun, who's trying to maintain some sort of ethic, but at the same time, in his quote-unquote real life outside the game, he's not really the best father. He's not really living up to his responsibilities. Is that just because he's down on his luck and he's not able and he's embarrassed? Like, what do we think about the, like, the personalities of these two, or not the personalities, but the character traits of these two that are clearly set up in opposition to each other? Of course, culminating in the final game where they play with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, God, yeah. I'm sorry, was the question there? I got distracted for 2 seconds because I'm trying to pay attention to our chat because everyone's saying great stuff.
And no, it's just more like, what do we think about the polarity of these two?
You've got
one who's like the golden boy, who is it just because he was the golden boy? And in my mind, this is how I, because they don't really give too much about why he's down on his luck. I'm thinking golden boy, majors in business, gets into some deep investment stuff, becomes totally just overwhelmed by debts. And he then has no other way to function except by playing in this game.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like some Wolf of Wall Street shit, right? Whatever the Wall Street equivalent is in Seoul. But, you know, like, I think the way he plays in the game, like when he cheats, when he backstabs, all that sort of stuff, I think we clearly get the idea that that's how he got himself into so much trouble, by playing ruthlessly in the game of economics. But of course, we know that if someone takes the fall in that world, the homies aren't getting your back. You're done. You're out like chum in the water, you know? So I think we get that sense that he did what he probably thought he was supposed to do. And of course, we know the background, that he's someone from, it seems like, a pretty working class, lower class environment. He hustled his ass off to get there, thought he was doing the things he was supposed to do, gets fucked over, is in this desperate situation. Whereas like June seems like someone who never even got how to play the game. You know, like, never understood the rules to begin with, which is why he's, you know, divorced, can't afford to buy his daughter a birthday present, living with his mother, you know, a version of that slacker type who, and to be clear, I'm not saying that he, like, resisted by not opting into the system, but he seems like someone who just never figured out how to play and naively got himself in trouble by trying to find like a quick way to make money, or even, of course, like,
which was the gambling.
Yeah. And I think the gambling too, I think someone in the chat said this as well. So if you did, props to you, but also touches on addiction, the way that there's a psychology here in that cycle, how someone could fall into that, how there's a relationship between debt and liquidity and gambling and pyramid schemes and like trying to acquire that power.
Yeah.
And it seems like he's fallen into a system that's a thing that's internal to society that's played right into that. And of course, you know,
is great. No, yeah,
well,
going,
no, just
going.
The irony there too, that, you know, June's someone who lost it all playing games, and now he has to try to win it all back playing games.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the thrill and the excitement that he gets from gambling and potentially having a win is amazing. Like, it's thrilling, it's exhilarating, but he seems to come across as somebody who's crushed by his debt relationship. Yeah. Whereas when we look at the asset rich in society, let's say a derivatives trader or something like that, or somebody who's like using high forms of leverage with multi-million dollars of debt, they don't often feel the consequences of that debt burden. And so even though they're maybe more indebted, quote unquote, in terms of real numbers, in terms of the consequences or the felt sense of feeling that indebtedness, it's not the same, right? And so there's actually there's a guy by the name of Amin Saman who wrote this really great article, and it's on like the eternal return in Nietzsche, and what he talks about is being like these two divergent structures of feeling between the asset rich and the asset poor. And the asset rich, they're the ones who play the game of finance, right? They play the games of debt and equity, but they do it in a way that is exhilarating and that is exciting because they're rewarded and they're a part of this system kind of constitutively, whereas the asset poor are the ones that are feeling this debt burden because, yeah, they might get a win every now and then, and yeah, they might have some sort of reward that comes in a flash, but perpetually they feel it as they're having to pay their rent, and they're having to pay their credit card bills, and they're having to pay their cell phone bills, and they're having to pay their car payments, and then they have their insurance payments, and it's this constant laboring under this debt burden, which is very different than the exhilarating side.
Well, and I think it's like compare the real estate developer to the college student, right? Both are in positions where they probably have to take on large amounts of debt. The real estate developer goes into tons of debt because he can continue to borrow against the asset. And if things go bad, bankruptcy, let's start over and go from there. So many, real estate development types especially do that. Sometimes I get annoyed. Currently, a developer might take over the last remaining solid bar in my neighborhood. So I have to look these people up. And it's just like, okay, you're someone that's done a bunch of bad deals before. And your reward for those bad deals is you get to build another 200-unit luxury building. But then, of course, you might have the student who – and I think we see this reflected in a lot of the younger characters in Squid Game – who – the student wants to do something honorable. She wants to take out money to live, to go to school, to get a job, to do the things she's supposed to. But if she screws up, she's fucked. You know, there's no bankruptcy. There's no asset to borrow against. And, you know, some of the people in Squid Game that we see are bad. I forget the name of the guys, like the gangster dude. Who's real? Oh, I think it's Ho Sung Tae. That's the actor's name. The character is Jang Duk-soo. But, you know, total piece of shit. I don't think we feel bad for him when he goes.
No.
I don't think we feel bad for him even, like, business-wise. Like, this guy seems like a total piece of shit. Very bad guy. But then you have some of the other folks.
Yeah.
And a lot of the younger characters trying their best. A character like Ali, who clearly, like, got screwed over by his employer, wants to provide for his family. We even see with Ali that, like, he lost fingers in the job he worked and wasn't provided for, you know, after the fact. So it just shows, I mean, I think that the difference you acknowledge there, like, we really, 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 really see that in these characters. And I do think it's important as well that, like, when we talk about all of this and we talk about indebted subjects, whatever it might be, we're not saying that makes anyone good or bad or virtuous or, you know, evil. There's a big moral range there. And I do think the show does a solid job of that as well, of not pretending that, like, people are inherently good because they have debt and people are inherently evil because they don't.
Well, I think that's one of the things that the show really does kind of explore is, and that's what I was wondering with this, like, Sang-woo character, because there is a lot of, like, reflection or mirroring of how people lived in their real lives that's also played out with how they either act in the game or how they die in the game, right? And so it is interesting to kind of think about how these people's characteristics, that's kind of what I was thinking about earlier, like, is Ji-hun, is he a good guy, right? Like, is he a good guy, and then he gets rewarded for being a good guy as the winner, and Sang-woo, he's a bad guy, and so he gets punished? Or, because Ji-hun is kind of, I don't know if I'd say he's a good guy, but there's an earnestness about him.
He's you know? A broken like guy, a, you know? There's like a brokenness.
He's a broken
openness.
Guy.
And he was kind of in a traditional, like, hero's journey type way, right? In storytelling. He is one of the characters. We see him change throughout the course of it. We see him respond to things, whereas in Sang-woo, we have someone who doubles down, who when things get tough, he doesn't change. We don't see his character alter or shift because of the journey and the tribulations. We see him sort of double down on the very type of behavior that got him there in the first place.
Now, what do we think about some of the other characters? I don't know if we want to call them, because it really is an ensemble cast.
Oh, for sure.
It's really nicely done, actually, how, like, Ji-hoon is the main character, but a lot of talk has gone around the figure of Il-nam, who is the older guy, player number one.
And I think throughout the show, Ji-hoon often just calls him, like, the old man.
Yeah,
that's how he's often referred to.
So what do we think about the old man? Because we learn that, okay, he claims that he's got, like, a brain tumor, and then what we learn at the end of it all is that he actually is the one who runs this whole game. Like, what the fuck do we do? Like, why did he set this? Is this just some rich guy that wanted to get his rocks off by, or did he really think, like, that there was something good that he could accomplish? Like, what is his deal? What is his motivation? What's he trying to prove or accomplish?
Yeah, and I might get the quote wrong, but he says something to the effect of, like, the two most unhappy people are the very poor and the very rich. So he sets up this sort of, like, dialectical opposites coming together, that in both positions, you are miserable. When you have nothing, you're miserable. And when you have everything, you're miserable, because everything is nothing and nothing is everything, yada, yada, yada. And I do think, like, I kind of like how when he's saying that in the scene, there's part of, you know, when I watched that, I was like, oh, no, is the show, like, trying to do a thing now where they're like, but you know what's rough, too? Being super rich. And I do like how Ji-hoon is just kind of like, fuck you. Like, he doesn't buy it. Like, he doesn't give into that. And I think it's telling, too, that, you know, you have that final scene where he wants to bet on if a unhoused person would be taken care of or freeze to death. And he just made that a game. So I don't. Yeah, I don't know. I think there was still, like, a very intense selfishness there. And something about the idea of, like, the ultra-rich man wanting to cosplay as an oppressed or vulnerable person.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know. What did you make of that?
Well, let's keep going back. I love this. I've just been obsessed lately with this notion of, like being a liquid subject, right? So if you are extremely wealthy, you are totally liquid. You can pretty much do anything you want. You want to take the afternoon off? You can take the afternoon off. You want to buy a golf course? You can buy a golf course. You want this kind of food? You can have that kind of food. You're craving this? You can kind of do that if you want, right? Now, that doesn't mean there are no consequences. Like, sure, you miss the afternoon meeting and you might, like, screw up something with your board members. That's not my point. My point is, though, is that you have the capacity to do this stuff, right? Whereas when you are asset poor, you don't have that capacity. So the difference, there's a fundamental difference. Like, maybe the rich, the super rich, are unhappy in Il-nam's sense, but he also has the ability to, like you just said, to cosplay as the poor, to cosplay as somebody who is asset poor. Whereas the asset poor, they don't have the option to cosplay as the asset rich, right? Like, they can try their damnedest, but it's not nearly going to be the same thing. So there's also a fundamental imbalance of capacity, of ability there. So I'm like, I was wondering too, like, why is he unhappy? Was it just because he was like, hey, you know, like, youth is filled with potency and with opportunity and the world is your oyster kind of thing, and then you get older and you realize you have responsibilities and board meetings and shareholder interests and yada yada yada, like, is that what he's getting at?
I wonder if it's kind of like the old Aristotle thing, when Aristotle talks about ways that we try to be happy that suck. I think it's like early on in the Nicomachean Ethics. But, you know, there's the thing about, like, money, and it's sort of like you could pursue wealth, but you pursue wealth for other means and it goes on infinitely. So, you know, the point Aristotle makes is there's never a clear end goal, never a clear telos. So you just end up in this cycle. And it seems like, in a sense, that's what's happened with this character. He's chased wealth accumulation at all costs, but there's no like meaning at the end of that tunnel other than more consumption and acquisition. And you get old and you're about to die because of a brain tumor. Like, what does it mean? And I don't think it means a lot. And, you know, that's a trope in a lot of TV and film, is like the rich old man at the end of his life. You know, what does it all mean? Rosebud, etc. But it's kind of how I read that a little. I think for me, that'd be like my most charitable reading of what's going on with that character.
Yeah, I think there's a tragic reading we can follow mm-hmm. on this too, which is the tragic reading is that, okay, so you got the super rich guy and you got the super poor guy, and they're the poles, right? Or the super poor people even, right? And then it's like, okay, so the super rich guy is able to do all these things because he's asset rich and he has that capacity to be a liquid subject. And then you've got the indebted people who are, they're in debt bondage, right? But they still have to be incorporated into the system to be able to become potent, which means then that the sources of power, the sources of capacity, the sources of your ability, the sources that can even make you function as a vital being are already played out before you in an economic system that determines that money is the thing that gives you capacity in a marketized society. And so here's where the tragedy is. The tragedy is that, okay, we can think of things potentially outside of economic reason, like family. Like, oh, maybe Il-Nam is depressed because he realizes this instrumental form of life that he's always kind of been in, trapped within, because you use money in order to get the thing, to get the thing, to get the thing, but it's this infinitely receding pursuit that never leads to the ultimate thing. But then you're like, ah, but then what is the thing that gives us value, that gives us meaning, that gives us joy? Family, maybe, right? And then you've got Ji-hun that has that opportunity to get a little bit of money and then maybe leave the game, leave the system, and then go be with the family, but he can't. He leaves at the end and he goes back probably into the game. Maybe it's to track people down. Maybe it's to who knows. There's all kinds of theories about why he leaves and doesn't become the father. But he could just, he's now a liquid subject. He's got this money. He could do the things, right? So he could do anything. Yeah. He could start a family life, but nah, he can't even do that. So it's almost like there's this no hope at the end of this. Even with the promise of like something like family that might seem like it's outside of the remit of economic reason, even that he can't do.
Well, and if the game is an analog for how, let's say, the economic structure of the world works, he's seen the end of it. You know what I mean? Like, he's been in this really accelerated version, this stripped down version without any of like the cute ideological superstructural stuff, and he's seen the core of the thing. It's sort of like in that really weird Matrix 3, let's not fight about the Matrix anyone, I'm sorry to piss anyone off, but in Matrix 3 we like see inside and it's like, okay, but I think he's like seen too much to believe that now a debit card with lots of money attached to it is going to save him. I think the knowledge. And, you know, too, what's his breaking point? His breaking point is seeing the guy in the train station getting swindled by the same dude. The thought that somebody else would go on that same path is unthinkable to him. So I would say, and there's a lot of really good thoughts in the chat about this, I still don't want to say if Jun's like a good guy or not. I will say that he seems to be morally affected by the end of it, and I think thinks outside of himself, because he is a very selfish character early on. He treats his mom like shit and steals money from her to go gambling. Like, that's not chill. Also, it takes advantage of her. His breakfast bonchon setup looks delightful. I wish I had someone that made me breakfast like that. but, you know, I think that there is some sort of, some place he gets by the end of it. But you're also right. He's just seen too much to be happy. And I think sometimes...
That's interesting,
But this happens, right? I think, Austin, you and I have seen this in life. Sometimes there's a type of person who... And sometimes it's just like a performative grad student type who reads about how bad the world is and just like can't be happy, can't just relax. I'll say this to everyone listening or watching. Austin and myself have hung out with multiple people in our lives, sometimes together and also separately, who have been so affected by knowing how the world works that they seemingly can't enjoy things. Or the person who, and I don't judge this person at all, who goes so deep into climate research that they just truly feel like, what is the fucking point? And I think that kind of despair is what we see in Ji-hun at the end of this, but who knows? Maybe he's going to go full Jason Bourne in season 2.
Well, again, I think that this comes back to not having the resources to be able to actually express a vital impulse.
Yeah.
Right?
Also, someone in the chat I have to say, someone in the chat brought up something that we forgot about. Oh, we do know this about Ji-hun, right? He was a part of that big union strike. We know that before his life fell apart, he was a worker at the auto factory. He watched people get like beat by the police as they were trying to stand up for those workers' rights. Everyone got fired. So there is this tragic backstory as well. That's not just he's a deadbeat. And I think it's very informative when he has that moment where he explains that to the old man. And is like, I'm not just a bag of shit. I did this thing. It was meaningful to me. We stood up for something, but we saw how one person could take over the company and ruin all of our lives. And I'm so sorry to interrupt.
This is great because this is a really strident point that really to me demonstrates again why the show is against neoliberal globalization and a lot of the kind of structural adjustment and infrastructure transformations at the policy level that characterize this global movement that has now become like water. It is the air we breathe. Well, I guess if it's water, it's the water we breathe because we're fish now. Shout out to DFW.
The water we drink.
The water we drink, yeah. The air we drink, whatever it is, right? And so the idea is that if in a previous era, let's call it the late Fordist economic era, what you had was really strong labor unions around the world that allowed for worker power to be able to compete over wages and the proportion of value that was going to be distributed between workers and owners, right? But once that power dynamic becomes shifted and workers no longer have power, you don't just get an automatic shift towards indebtedness, but what you have is you have a group of people who become incapacitated because their wages aren't keeping up with the standard of living, so their purchasing power becomes diminished. So what do they increasingly have to resort to? Credit. And this is what we have seen. We have seen this exponential boom since the late 1970s, exponential boom in the expansion of not just credit in the form of like credit cards, but everything now is a credit instrument, a debt instrument. And so people have to rely on that. So what I think this is another instance that this show is clearly anti-capitalist. I saw some dude with a baby brain on Twitter. Do you know the guy that wears a beanie? Is it Tim Pool? I can't remember.
Oh, guy sucks.
Tim Pool. No, this isn't even baby brain. This is like pre-cum brain. Like this guy said that the show was anti-communist, and I was like, wait, how? Come on, bro. Like, how is it anti-communist? I'm not saying it's pro-communist, but I'm saying that the show is clearly anti-capitalist. Like, if you want to say it's anti-crony capitalism or anti-something like that, that's fine. I don't really care. But there is no way that this show could in any way be somehow like anti-socialist, anti-communist. It is clearly a critique against neoliberal globalization in the expansion of finance and the expansion of finance mechanisms. Clearly.
And as you were saying the thing, no, totally. And as this is baby pre-cum baby brain take. but I do think something you said before maybe as well. So we are in a movie podcast. I think a great movie that if anyone's listening to this and they're thinking about like you know the end of the Fordist era, the beginning of this era of sort of the end of unions, the beginning of Indebted Man, all that sort of stuff, Harlan County, USA is a great documentary that's about a mine in I think West Virginia. No, is it Kentucky? Or I think West Virginia. And like, kind of you see what happens in this era when you know, privatization hits an industry that's long been unionized, how it affects people's lives. And just a great way to kind of, you know, if you'd rather watch a fun doc than read a bunch of dry text, it captures a moment really well. And I definitely thought about it when June was talking about his experience. And I do think it's still on, I think it's on like HBO Max and maybe the Criterion Channel thing as well, if anyone wants to stream that. Had to drop that in.
Cool. I do want to say, so someone in the chat, it's Hippopotamus Bosch said, should we be applying Western philosophy to a Korean series? So one of my favorite philosophers is a Korean philosopher named Byung-Chul Han. And I have talked about Byung-Chul Han on this podcast many, 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 many a time. I know Michael has recently gotten into Byung-Chul Han within the last year or two, maybe, right?
Because of you. Yeah. You talked about and recommended him. So I got some books. And honestly, one of the most exciting and interesting philosophers actors I've read in the past decade. Love his work.
I think so. His most famous work or most well-known book is on the Burnout Society. My favorite of his is called The Agony of Eros. Mm-hmm. He's also written books on like beauty, and he has written a book on Zen Buddhism, which is only translated. So he writes in German and Korean, and that one's translated into Spanish, but most of his books are translated into English. And he writes a lot about what we might call the late capitalist era as being characterized by the development of achievement subjects, that we are all kind of entrepreneurs, kind of working on ourselves. But the main thrust of all of this is that there's no lack and no negativity. So there's no like discipline, there's no pain, but we are all caught up in this system willingly and we enjoy it. And so there's like this perpetual working on ourselves that is valorized by this society that kind of hooks us in a little bit more without it being like something that beats us over the head or punishes us. And I wonder if there is something about this show that, because there's this reward and because there's this like maybe this almost theological, like this divine relationship to that big ball of money that's up there, is there something about Han's work? Like, what's, you know, this Han talks a lot about how like in social media, like whenever you press the like button, that's like the amen. So he's not above using religious language. I wonder if we could think about Han, we could think about the kind of religious aspect, you know, like,
I think the Han thing is really great. And I'm glad someone asked that question. I mean, I do think too, it is interesting. The one sort of academic text we see in the show is a book by psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, Lectures on Theory of Desire, I think. So then I think that plays into it well. And obviously Han's work interacts with the psychoanalytic tradition to an extent, as far as I'm, you know, I feel like you read all of it. Yeah.
I
definitely think it gets at that. And I do think for me, one of the most striking images of the show, and I definitely a part of the show, I forget if we see this in episode one or two, where it's like, okay, we're not being subtle here in a good way, is when we gaze at the ball of money with a golden light shining behind it, like Christ above us trying to give us redemption, and the way that that's the thing that pulls them back as well. So I definitely can see that there. And I do think as well, along with thinking about it in terms of, you know, the Western, non-Western philosophy thing, which is a great question. You know, I also think too, South Korea has a very specific relationship with debt that is similar to a lot of Western countries, but not the same. And there's been a few really good articles about this in the past week or so, getting at the economic differences in Korean society, the debt to income ratio in people in their 30s over there. So I do think we can apply it very well to most societies, especially, you know, as Americans that live in free market economies, and, you know, part-time Australians, we can apply it to ourselves pretty well. But there is a specificity to the contemporary Korean economic situation, which I think does add context. And if you like the show and you haven't read a little bit about that, we quoted a few pieces to talk about this in the Wisecrack video we made, but worth looking into. And for me, at least, it kind of illuminated aspects of the show.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is also really interesting, there's also a particular influx and I'm trying to think of influence of Westernized evangelical Christianity that is quite potent within the borders of South Korea, within the population. And there's the one character that is explicitly Christian, that is, you know, quoting the Bible, reading the Bible, praying, giving thanks to God. And I think that there's something also about, and there's a lot written about this, about the relationship between God, theology, indebtedness, again, to talk about Nietzsche and Lazzarato, and then also, yeah, go ahead.
And another thing too, our old buddy Philip Goodchild, if you want to read more about debt and sort of the theology of money and all these sort of things, just look up the name Philip Goodchild. He's written a lot of really good books on this topic.
And I, again, this is very on the nose for me. It's something that I'm kind of developing in my own thought, but I think that there's essentially a very religious ethic to the global, what sometimes is called the Wall Street consensus. A colleague of mine, Ilias Astami, has written about this, about how there is a shift towards the kind of financialization of global capital flows. But one of the things that I think accompanies that is this like promise of redemption, that if you just get enough, then you're going to be saved, right? And so there's always that promise of freedom. And so you get that very explicitly with these people, that they'll be out of debt bondage. But I think you also just get that within a societal frame. Yeah. That's like that if you participate and you assent to it, then you're justified. You're clean because you're a part of the system. And then it's a lifelong process of bettering yourself, you know? And in Christian terms, they would use the word sanctified. Or we could say you become more holy, right? So the more, I don't know, the more you embed yourself into the system, you know, the more pure you become because you're a better participant in the Wall Street consensus, so to speak.
Yeah, well,
and then the promise is always what? Ultimate salvation, right? Mm-hmm. And it's always the carrot that's being dangled in front of you.
Yeah, and I think it's another thing when you read about economic trends in South Korean society, there's a marked parallel between the rise of Christianity, which I think really got booming in the 70s. In Korea, I think Lutheranism in particular, but I might be wrong there. Shouts to my favorite Korean Christian, Mrs. Kim from Stars Hollow on Gilmore Girls. really,
dude,
taught me a lot about ferocious Korean conservatism in their religious belief. But you know, I think that might be one of the biggest points of overlap between kind of the Western and Korean conception of things at play there. I do know we've been talking about this for a while. I have to ask you one thing. What do you think about Squid Game as a story? We're talking a lot about the big ideas here. I'm just curious, like, do we like this because it lets us talk about all this sort of stuff, which we want to talk about? Or do we genuinely like the story being told and appreciate on top of that the fact that it's provided the occasion for us to, you know, riff about economic philosophy for a while? And I don't even know if I know the answer for myself. So I'm just kind of curious, is it, and this is me being like devil's advocate-y, is this just serving up so much like, ooh, hitting zeitgeisty political things that we're missing the fact that maybe the story's not incredible?
It's fine. Mm-hmm. It's fine. It's fine, you know? Like, it's not doing anything that, to me, pulls at the heartstrings. I mean, the construction of the story is pretty simple and formulaic. Like, you even talked about the hero's journey and then, you know, the deadbeat dad thing. And it's kind of like, okay, those things are there for sentimental, to score their sentimental points. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's fine. It's well executed. It's pretty simple in its formula, minus the American actors or the rich actors when they come in. The acting is really great.
So good.
I think the aesthetic is amazing. I love that fucking, what is it? Esch kind of stairs fucking thing.
Oh,
where you're
yeah.
Like, what it feels like. Like Escher kind of thing.
Yeah, MC
like
Escher.
That's kind of rad.
Yeah, visually.
Yeah,
it's
that's kind of rad.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I love the idea that they're taking kids' games but making them murderous. I think that's kind of fun. But you know, it's fine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at its best, I think it reminds me of the best parts of the horror genre, especially early horror, when we, you know, when horror was used to talk about things in society and get at inequality, social issues, all that sort of stuff. The same thing that makes like Jordan Peele's work interesting now. I think that part of it is really great. And I think that the show is supposed to be kind of fun. And I think they do.
Yeah.
I, you know what I mean? I don't think it's like someone brought up in the chat earlier, and I haven't watched the show yet. This show on Netflix, Made, that sounds like it gets at issues.
I just finished it.
Yeah.
I just finished
it. Okay. So it sounds like that's a show that's exploring in a very real way class disparity and things like that. But
yeah,
and more of an emotional focused story that's not fun, but it's good. You've watched it,
so it's not fun.
Yeah, yeah. So I think in a sense, like, it did a good job,
but it's good.
Yeah, but yeah, I think Squid Game does a good job at providing a fun show that's compelling to watch, that gives us things to think about. I think that's a hard thing to do,
very hard,
and it does a pretty good job. And I would rather watch a show that swings at something like that, and you know, makes contact with the ball, maybe isn't scoring, but does a decent job, then something doesn't try at all. You know, so I hope that it motivates people And I guess I don't want to say make, because there's tons of people that want to make stuff like this. I hope that it maybe gets people's projects funded that want to make things like this. What I hope doesn't happen, though, is that like it leads to, and I mean, it will, right? But I'm not excited about maybe the shitty imitations with nothing to say that come in the wake of this, that operate at a real surface level, which is inevitable. Anytime something pops in Hollywood or in music or whatever, we're going to see shitty versions of that that are a little bit hollow to follow. So I'm not excited about that part.
Yeah, there's a John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell version of this where it's like the two of them go in together. It's like a super, super...
Well, I mean, that sounds pretty good.
A super comedy version?
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, I'll watch anything that John C. Reilly's in. So actually, now that I talk about it, I'm kind of into the idea.
Oh, God, yes.
But so I will say this. The most emotional I got was the Marvel episode?
Six.
Okay. The relationship between Say Biok and I can't remember the other woman's name.
Oh, my God, that scene.
I cried like a baby in that one. And then before we find out that Il-Nam is the mastermind, that kind of whole manipulation of his dementia. And then when fucking Ali gets stabbed in the back, I was like, you fucker, Sung-woo.
I fucking screamed.
I was so mad.
But here's the thing. Episode six is a wonderful episode of television. Yeah. And it's really good storytelling. Yeah.
It is. But you only get there, though, because it's built up our attachment to Ali, our care about, say, Biok, and her being like a refugee from, from North Korea. And so it does do some good job, a really good job of like making us care about these characters. And for me, it was that episode that was like the perfect kind of culmination of that. And it was very heavy. We took like a 2-day break, I think, after that. And we were like, let's just let this sit for a second. And then I think the next episode is the rich people come in. And it's like, oh my God.
That was the sequence of the show. I could have maybe missed that episode. Because it was a little bit like you eat this gourmet meal and then right after someone comes in with like a half-eaten Snickers bar and is like, here's what's next.
VIPs, here they come.
Haha. I like to watch the poor die. Do you? Nice mask. Listen, I think I read this somewhere, Jesus, that like it was really a matter of, in like an intense lockdown period, they just had to like near where they were producing the show be like, we need to find some English speaking actors who are available to do this. Because I think it was a thing where like they couldn't like fly folks in. Or at least that's the most charitable explanation for that. But yeah, I will say this as well, just so we mention this and so no one says like, but you didn't talk about this. There's been some conversation as well about the translations in English. And I will just say, if anyone is interested in that conversation, this week on Culture Binge, another Wisecrack podcast, we had a great guest who's Allison Herman, who's the main TV writer over at The Ringer. And it was our first topic we talked about. So if you feel like we didn't get into that, you wanted to hear us talk about it, go listen to the first 20 minutes of the most recent episode of Culture Binge and you'll hear that discussion.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
That sounds good. Well, look, I mean, I feel like we could talk about this show continuously. I actually, for a little bit, I was like, I didn't know if we were going to fill up the whole hour. Were we going to get into other stuff? I mean, I feel like we are even kind of scratching the surface. So let me say this. If you want to contribute to this conversation, definitely make sure you email us or call us and leave us a voicemail, and we can talk a little bit more about Squid Game at the end of further episodes or future episodes, I should say. So you can email us at movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co, or you can call us and leave us a voicemail at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. We've been getting some voicemails, but they've been really long. They've been like 3 minutes long, and as much as we love to hear your voice, we can't play a 3 minute long voicemail on the air. So if you can, try to keep them concise and short. If you want to kind of elaborate and expound a little bit more, then maybe email is the better format. It's just unfortunately we can't play the whole voicemail, right? So today what we're going to do is we're going to quickly just do a couple of emails from the mailbag before we get out of here. The first one is from Steven on Pan's Labyrinth. Basically, here it goes. Hey, guys, love the podcast. I wrote an article on Pan's Labyrinth and wanted to share it / get some feedback from y'all. I heard y'all talk about the Pale Man at the end of your Nightcrawler podcast, and I have some thoughts. In my understanding, Captain Vidal represents the forces of indoctrination that drove both the Spanish Inquisition and the Spanish Civil War. The abundant Catholic imagery and Vidal's torture methods support this connection with the Spanish Inquisition. The Fawn, however, represents the freedom of choice present within an open-hearted framework. When choice is subjected to the high demands of perfect faith, as present in the fascistic machinations of both Axis politics and medieval Catholicism, the Fawn turns into the Pale Man. This is why the Fawn and the Pale Man are played by the same actor, and why the Pale Man takes Vidal's place at the dinner table. Both the Fawn and the Pale Man are representations of choice as manifested in either the indoctrinal or the mystical framework. Vidal and the Pale Man offer a certain kind of choice. Choose to align your beliefs with mine or die. The Fawn, however, offers a different kind of choice. Choose to trust yourself or compromise your values. Now, there's a lot going on here, but Steven wrote this. You can check out Steven's Substack. It's cool. Steven McIntosh. So MACKINTOSH. So you can check that out with the rest of the essays up there. I mean, I think that's a great comparison. I think that's a great way of thinking about it. Yeah. And I do like that. I do think that the Fawn Pale Man comparison are supposed to be opposites, and I do, because I know a lot of people are like, why does she eat the fucking fruit in front of the Pale Man? Like, why? Like, it's clear. And then Raymond made a really good point that she actually learned, she got rewarded from not listening to the fairy whispering in her ear and not going into the first keyhole, but going into the second keyhole. And then she's like, oh, so maybe if the fairy's telling me not to eat, maybe I can eat again. So there's some interesting stuff going on here with regards to like reward, expectation, choice, capacity. I don't know. I dig it. Interesting thoughts.
Very, very interesting. And kind of like our discussion today, gets at a lot of stuff about the overlapping of political and religious forces, which was obviously very heavy if you look at the modern history of Spain. So hell yeah. But also, like, kids are hungry, man. Kids don't have impulse control. Like, of course you're going to eat. Come on.
I'm pretty sure there was a big psychological experiment about that sort of thing. Maybe people can Google
marshmallows, that. Baby.
Anyway, and then we've got another one from James who wants to talk about the birdcage. Hey, Wisecrack, I really enjoyed Riley's take that Val was the real villain. Val is the son. That's Robin Williams' son. Mm-hmm. I was surprised that no one really talked about Calista Flockhart's character of Barbara. I don't see her as a villain, but I forgot she was the one who panicked and lied to her parents about Val's parents. I always liked that. Despite being raised in an ultra-conservative family, she was all on board with accepting Armand and Albert into her family. It's good to see when the kids become more open-minded than their parents. Also, I always enjoyed that the fact that Val and Armand seemed to think that Albert's flamboyant nature would expose the lie, but as soon as he was there in drag, he was more calm than Armand and Val. He even recovered well with the Coleman-Goldman thing and the excuse of lateness by visiting her parents. Meanwhile, Armand and Val were panic drinking from that bottle every time they stepped out of the room. Albert was set up to be the reason the act wouldn't work, and yet he, in drag, appeared to be the only thing genuine to the senator. Interesting.
Love it. I also love Riley's take there. I love Riley. So glad that y'all had her on. Such a fun episode. Such a great movie. Shouts to anything that Mike Nichols and Elaine may have ever touched. But yeah, I love the reading that Val's the bad guy.
Now, you weren't on that episode, but I'd love to hear you tweeted out the absolute god, Elaine May. I mean, you're an improv dude, so just real quick, 20 seconds. Why should people care about Elaine May and Mike Nichols?
Mike Nichols and Elaine May invented the way we do improv and sketch comedy in the modern era. You can trace everything back. Anything you've liked comedically that's been produced in America in the past 70 years, you can trace a line back to Mike Nichols and Elaine May, and they were doing it better than most people, and they were funny and politically poignant when they were in their early 20s in Chicago. Look them up. Lots out there. They're the fucking best.
That's amazing. All right, let's get out of here, brother. Where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, Wisecrack is one place to find me. I'm on lots of stuff there. And if you want to holler at me on Twitter, Instagram, it's at Michael O. Burns. And on Instagram, there's some underscores around the O's. More importantly, where are you? Where can everyone get at you?
I'm in the Twitter sphere, Austin_Hayden. I'm in the Insta sphere, AUS_HAY. I've got a YouTube channel, Austin Hayden. I recently just did a video with our old buddy Jared from Wisecrack on the greatest actors of all time. Who is the greatest actor? Spoiler alert, it's Marlon Brando. But also Keanu Reeves is probably higher in the list than you guys might think. So check out that madness. Oh, and Benedict Cumberbatch is probably lower than some of you might want. And I'm probably going to get some flack for that. I already have a little bit, but check that out.
Wow.
And yeah, that's pretty much it. Also, check out Culture Binge. Check out our other podcast, the back catalog of The Squanch, which is the Rick and Morty podcast. Are we still doing South Park, by the way?
No, we are not.
Respect our authority. But it's still online, so if you want, you can go back and check out the backlog catalog of that. Yeah, find us, subscribe us, follow us, email us, call us, all that good stuff. We're going to get out of here. Michael, send us out by however you want.
Live from Los Angeles, California, this has been Show Me the Meaning, featuring Austin and Michael. We'll be back soon. In the meantime, good night and good luck.